Okay, so as I mentioned before the meal, today's theme, overall theme, is practicing daily life, and the topic is love, attachment, and friendship. So those are topics that are relevant in daily life, comes up all the time, and will be working through that as coming at it from different angles and different perspectives, and have we'll begin with Ajahn Kurundamo will begin it, start it off. Ajahn Yaniko will top it up, and then I'll see if there's anything left to say after that. But also just to encourage people to be asking questions also. As we go along, there will be time sort of as we keep walking through this or working through these themes, there'll be time for questions. So to not be too shy. And is how to navigate these realms of the human relationships. So I'll turn it over to Ajahn Kurundamo to begin.
Could we have it a tiny bit louder, please?
Sorry. He's got it. There we go.
Zooming in. So yes, again, welcome to everybody. We've got some special groups.
It's counterintuitive, but
oh, okay.
It actually picks up.
It should be pointed away from me.
Yeah, it picks up from that.
Oh, okay. Is that better?
It's much better.
Great. We have some special groups of people who come. Haven't seen them on our other Upasaka days, a group of students from the City of 10,000 Buddhas, welcome, and their instructors, two bhikshunis from there as well, I think, two?
Yeah.
I don't see you, okay. And then also Rick Center's group from San Francisco, coming up for their sort of annual visit, coinciding with Upasaka Day, so welcome to Rick's group, and then of course all the regulars and guests who are staying here. So our also just a bit of an apology for the lack of welcome today. Our entire Upasaka planning group, the three folks who help us gather together are all sick, so none of them showed up today. We're able to show up today, so we didn't have our proper greeting going, so. But as Lumpa mentioned, today's topic, love, attachment, and friendship, is the theme of the day. I don't know how many people on the reading list, we mentioned this book on love by Ajahn Jayasaro. I don't know if anybody did. How many people got a chance to kind of take a look at that? Okay. Few people, that's great. It's a really very, very well-written book by Ajahn Jayasaro, taken from a talk that he gave and then modified somewhat, and kind of goes through many of the good parts and the downsides of what we're calling love here. And I'll tease that out in a minute. And presents a very very nice balance. I was reading through it, and so some of the things that I mentioned here you probably recognize if you've read it. I took a few ideas from his writing to flesh out what I wanted to mention this morning. And as Lumpa mentioned, I'll have some things to talk about here, and then hopefully. As I finish, we'll have some time for questions and answers. So as I'm going ahead and introducing the topic, please, if you think of questions, keep them in mind for when we have the time for questions and answers. I think that, as Ajahn Jayasaro mentioned in the introduction, or in the first part of his book, we use the word, in the English language, the word love is used to in many different ways. In fact, he came up with four different ways that, general ways that the word love is used. One of them is the very casual form, like, I love ice cream, or, I love listening to music, or things like that. Basically, it's an exaggerated form of like, something I like, a pleasurable kind of, thing. Sometimes we use the word also in regards to certain ideals, like love of country or our religion, love of religion. And it's another way that we describe a certain affinity for more of a philosophical or a standpoint, a view of some sort, like ideals. And then... probably not going to talk too much about those today, at least not intentionally, but more of the other two types that he talks about, which would be personal love, and then also metta, loving kindness, as the two topics that I think are of most interest to people, and kind of teasing out a little bit about the difference between personal love, how attachments form, the metaphysics of attachments, the downside of attachments, and then a bit on the more boundless quality of metta, loving kindness. Lung Pao mentioned just before at the mealtime blessing that there's a certain framework that the Buddha often uses when talking about relating to our engagement with the sensory world. But also it fits into, I think, how we relate to people with this personal kind of love. A Pali word that's often used for this personal kind of love is it's the word piya, P-I-Y-A, which generally means like dear, or someone who is dear to you, or something that is dear to you. And that this kind of personal love... has its benefits, it has its gratification, something that makes us feel good. It also has its downside, which we'll go into as well. And then what we call the escape or the release from the attachment that's related to these certain qualities. So it's a framework, if you're familiar with the Pali teachings, that you'll see frequently in regard to any kind of sensory experience, anything through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, smell, and then also the intellect is one of the six sense bases, the thoughts and ideas that we have. And that gratification, danger, and escape is a certain framework that the Buddha uses to describe how we engage with that. So along those lines, I think it's useful to consider what is the gratification. We have personal love. What is personal love, to begin with? It's that kind of love or affection, endearment we have for our parents, for our relatives, friends of ours, partners, spouses, children. That kind of sense of wish for their well-being, concern for their health, welfare, safety, that is part of being in a human world of relationships. And there's advantages and benefits. There is a good side or a gratification to this kind of personal love. One is that as human beings, there's just this general need for companionships. You know, human beings are social beings, and I think there is plenty of studies that show that it's actually absolutely necessary for survival in infancy, this kind of personal love with particularly the mother, father, some sort of caring relationship. And that infants that are deprived of physical contact with a parent or a parent type figure in their early lives, they don't thrive. They end up actually having a lot of more physical illness, generally a lot of psychological problems throughout their adulthood, even if it's just in the early infancy. That's a very important time. Even early death has been described in a much higher percentage with infants that don't have that kind of personal affection from an adult who's looking after them. So it's built in almost, in a sense, to our being that we need to have, at least in the beginning stages, some sort of loving contact, relationship with other beings to survive. And then just in general, as we get older, again, you know, we're social animals, and friendship, support from others is generally part of what makes up a lot of our well-being. Even in the Sangha, you know, the Buddha's famous words to Ananda, when Ananda says, Ananda's reflecting on the Sangha as being, you know, part of the holy life, a very important part of the holy life. And the Buddha says, say not so, Ananda, it's the whole of the holy life. So this importance of being with people who are going to be in relation and supportive to you in many ways. So there's no question that there's at least at some degree, a need for this kind of relationship, and that there's a certain gratification that comes from that. Gives people a sense of security and comfort in what can be a difficult and lonely world. You know, you hear people talking a lot about loneliness and the isolation that comes. Particularly, it seems to be growing in this modern world of technology, where it's easier and easier to not have to actually ever see a human being. You can do everything from the comfort of your little home office. These kind of personal relationships do give that kind of sense of security and comfort. It's also, at least in romantic or personal relationships, it can be a skillful alternative to just, you know, having random multiple sexual partners, which can get you into all sorts of physical and emotional trouble. And that if a person wants to be in the world with sexual relationships, then a skillful personal relationship is probably a better alternative than not having that. So there's a lot of advantages, gratification, support that is attained through having these kinds of personal interrelationships. And it's important to recognize that. So it's also, you know, in part of the way of looking at it, these are, you know, this kind of personal love is part of the conditioned realm. It's not the highest form of relationship that the Buddha talks about, because there are disadvantages. And this is where, if you take a Buddhist perspective, we look at these kind of relationships from a little bit broader perspective, and from a little bit more perspective with discernment, perspective with wisdom. And most of us, I think, are familiar with the teachings of the three characteristics of the conditioned realm: unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and not self. And the disadvantage, essentially, of this kind of personal love is in its changeability, in its impermanent aspect. And that eventually, even in the best of relationships, there's going to be change. Even, you know, as people age, as they get older, sick, and then pass away. Even in the most stable, the most best of all relationships are going to end sometime. And if we've kept our eggs all in that one basket in terms of the support we get, and the way we relate to people, then when that change comes, it's going to be very, very painful. The more we depend on the presence of, say, one or a couple of other beings solely, the more painful it's going to be when that eventual change happens. And of course, as we all know, these kind of changes happen oftentimes well before death. Divorce, separation, people grow apart, develop different interests, and that leads to the painful kind of separation. So even in the best of worlds, it's time limited. It's also these kind of personal relationships tend to be subject to our own and other people's what the Pali word kilesa, defilements or bad habits or underlying tendencies. And so we enter into these kind of relationships not usually with the most pure state of clarity. We often have unrealistic expectations of what our personal relationships will provide to us. You know, particularly like in the early stages of romantic love, there's this intense infatuation and the ability to totally screen out any kind of faults or difficulties that somebody might have, and to just hone in on what seems to be attractive or what seems to be wonderful. And we have this great ability to just completely screen out anything else. And then when time goes on, get to know people better, and all of a sudden their little faults start to surface, this sense of disappointment can come in. And it's like, well, it's, you're not the person I remember. You're not the person I was interested in 6 months ago. Or if there's, you know, a sense of, you know, jealousy sometimes, like a person that you're interested in and involved with in a relationship, and all of a sudden they start to develop an interest in somebody else, you know, the kind of dukkha, the kind of suffering that comes from that kind of jealousy. It can be very minor bits, just when, you know, your partner or your friend kind of just takes a sidelong glance at somebody else, or quite great if they actually end up leaving you for another person, which seems to be happening a lot these days. To its greatest extent, it can lead to crimes of passion. People get murdered for jealousy, jealous relationships. So that's always a potential in the world. Unrequited love, when you really are looking for a personal relationship bond with somebody else and they're not interested in you. You know, the painful feeling of that. I remember when I was in high school, a group of friends that we would hang out together a lot, do a lot of things together as friends, but there was a situation where it was a couple of men, a couple of women, and one of the women was interested in one of the other men, but he wasn't interested in her. But he was interested in another person, another woman in the group of friends, but she wasn't interested in him. And I just have this memory of these, you know, like these awful entangled moments of gnawing, you know, angst in this group of people nobody was interested. There weren't two people who were actually both interested in each other. I'm thinking to myself, oh, this is painful to watch. So, you know, that happens, and that's kind of one of the downsides. So, you know, obviously there are a few very fortunate relationships along these lines that do stand the test of time. And, you know, you hear stories of people living out their lives, you know, married for 50, 60, 70 years and have a very caring, concerned relationship with each other. And that's a, you know, there still is this, the impermanence and the difficulty that eventually death will come. And, you know, the statistics are very clear. And how many times have you heard just stories of, you know, the wife or the husband finally passing away at, you know, the age of 85 or 90 or 95, and within months, sometimes even weeks, the other spouse dies too. It's just because they don't know how to be without the other in the world. So can be very skillful while it's all happening, and then it changes. And again, this doesn't have to happen, but there's also the potential, the tendency, I think, in those kind of personal relationships, because it's so comfortable, because it's so mutual and generally can be quite friendly and supportive, that and oftentimes one develops this sense of dependency on that for one's own well-being, so that you know, if your partner, your spouse is always ready there to say how wonderful you are, and, you know, what a wonderful person, you've done this, you know, you're great, I so appreciate your presence. You get that kind of you know, emotional lift, uplift from that. And then it has a tendency to prevent one from being able to develop that for oneself on one's own. And, you know, you can describe it almost in kind of like a codependent, to use a psychological word, so that you become unconsciously depending on that person's appreciation for you, for your own sense of well-being. And when you're not around that, it's much harder for you to develop it on your own, that sense of ease and caring and concern security in oneself, if you've depended on somebody else for that kind of feedback. Then also there can be the attachment or worry that comes in, say, for instance, relationships with children. You know, your 16 or 17-year-old son or daughter is gone out on the town, and it's getting after midnight, and you're wondering, where are they? Why aren't they, you know, calling in? They know their curfew is midnight. And the amount of worry and anxiety that can come with that kind of relationship. And people, as Ajahn Jayasaro points out, I quote from his book, "Rather than considering worry and jealousy to be impurities of love, we take them to be proof of it." So, you know, we get the worry or the concern or the jealousy in the relationships, and we feel like, oh, well, this is love. This is what love is all about. You know, I feel this way. I'm concerned about you because I love you. But don't see that actually that's kind of an unskillful defilement of the mind based on attachment. And it really is separate from love, but conjoined with it. So those are some of the what we would call the disadvantages or the danger in these kind of relationships. There's a short sutta from the Udana, one of the collections in the Tripitaka, or in the canon, that I want to read. It's one that maybe some of you have read before. It's called the Visakha Sutta. Visakha was one of the foremost disciples of the Buddha. She supported the community almost endlessly and very generously throughout the life of the Buddha's teachings. "I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying near Sawati at the Eastern Monastery, the palace of Migara's mother." And Migara's mother, that's oftentimes how Visakha is referred to. "And on that one occasion, a dear and beloved grandson of Visakha, Migara's mother, had died. So Visakha, her clothes wet, her hair wet, went to the Blessed One in the middle of the day, and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As she was sitting there, the Blessed One said to her, "Why have you come here, Visakha? Your clothes wet, your hair wet, in the middle of the day." When this was said, she said to the Blessed One, "My dear and beloved grandson has died. This is why I have come here, my clothes wet, my hair wet, in the middle of the day. Visakha, would you like to have as many children and grandchildren as there are people in Sawati?" "Yes, Lord, I would like to have as many children and grandchildren as there are people in Sawati." "But how many people in Sawati die in the course of a day?" "Sometimes 10 people die in Sawati in the course of a day. Sometimes 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. Sometimes one person dies in Sawati in the course of a day. Sawati is never free from people dying." "So what do you think, Visakha? Would you ever be free of wet clothes and wet hair?" Which is the standard way of mourning, showing grief at that time. "No, Lord. Enough of my having so many children and grandchildren. Visakha, those who have 100 dear ones have 100 sufferings. Those who have 90 dear ones have 90 sufferings. Those who have 80, 70, 60, 50, 40, 30, 20, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. Those who have one dear one have one suffering. Those who have no dear ones have no sufferings. They are free from sorrow, free from stain, free from lamentation, I tell you." Then, on realizing the significance of that, the Blessed One on that occasion exclaimed, "The sorrows, lamentations, the many kinds of suffering in the world exist dependent on something dear. They don't exist when there's nothing dear. And thus, blissful and sorrowless are those for whom nothing in the world is anywhere dear. So one who aspires to the stainless and sorrowless shouldn't make anything dear in the world anywhere." So, you know, to the Western ear, maybe that sounds a bit stark or bereft of enjoyment or bereft of pleasure. But I think you have to kind of take that in the context of the word dear and really talking about this kind of personal love that comes with attachment. And realizing, as the Buddha's pointing out, that the more you have of that, the more you depend on that, the more you engulf your life in those kinds of relationships that lead to attachment and dependence, the harder it is when separation comes, when it ends, when it changes. So that kind of sounds a bit bleak, but going along in the sequence of gratification, danger, then there's the escape from this kind of particular form of suffering from attachment and personal love. I think, you know, first of all, you know, before we talk about more of the boundless quality of metta, to mention that, you know, actually aren't all that many people in the world who are interested in letting go of that kind of relationship. And so if one is to engage in the world and to use these relationships for all the benefits that they can provide, then one wants to minimize, at least, if not able to eliminate, all the disadvantages. And developing a skillful approach and an eyes-open approach to these personal relationships can be very useful. This is where you have to start using your own discernment and your own wisdom so that you're entering into these kind of relationships with your eyes open, not with any kind of delusion of false expectation or any kind of unrealistic hope for what it can provide. So just knowing, you know, that these things are part of the conditioned realm, they're going to change. And just accepting that right from the get-go so that you don't have that kind of illusion or expectation of permanence, stability in a situation that's inherently unstable. Also keeping in mind, you know, as spiritual practitioners, that to the best possible ability to use these kinds of relationships for spiritual support, for encouraging each other along the spiritual path, and always keeping that as the primary goal, so that encouraging your friends, your children, your parents, your partners, to keep in mind the goal of what we're trying to do, and always moving in that direction. And then learning how to be a good spiritual friend to people, developing the qualities of non-judgmentalness, unqualified support, assisting them when they're in trouble, and being available as a good friend. So those are some qualities to bring into relationships when you decide to be part of that. In part of that process, and then realizing that the culmination or the highest form of this of what we would call love is what the Buddha calls metta, or loving kindness. And you've all probably heard and studied some on what metta is, and perhaps Ajahn Janako and Lungpa will be talking more about that. I'll just briefly mention some of the advantages of this quality of metta, this sense of caring, concern, well-wishing for the happiness and contentment of other people, that can be brought to a very non-personal level. And that's the kind of love that as monastics that we try to practice and encourage everyone else as well, even if not in monastic life. Because it's non-personal, it's not just one person. You're not just focusing it on one person. You're developing it as a quality that's inside, as your own potential that you can then experience with anybody, even people you don't like. You can experience this kind of loving kindness for this well-wishing, this concern. You don't have to like somebody to be able to experience metta for them. And it's unconditional. It's not dependent on getting back anything. So much in our personal love relationships or friendships, even if it's not conscious, we're expecting something back in some way. And if we don't get something back, then we don't feel it's a good relationship. So metta is universal. It doesn't have this sense of expecting something back from somebody. It's just this, unqualified sense of well-being and consideration, happiness, wish for the happiness of one for oneself and others. And it's potentially a boundless quality in terms of consciousness. It's not limited to just my own being, although this is the place to start. We use it, how we experience that kind of loving kindness, as our reference point. And then we kind of expand our awareness to include all other beings that we come in contact with. And it can be, in terms of levels of consciousness, it can extend our own awareness into what we call the boundless. And within that kind of boundless space, there's also the ability to start using wisdom and discernment, because we start to see things much more clearly and with wisdom from that kind of spacious mind that isn't honed into and glommed on to, attached to, clinging to a particular person or a group of people. Or a set of ideas or a set of experiences, the mind that is open and more unattached and moving towards that boundless quality is one that can actually see the whole events of our lives, the whole realm of conditions, in a much more clear, discerning way. We can see the transitoriness of dependent relationships and accept that. That's just part of the nature of the human world. Everything, including relationships with people, skillful, unskillful, has a quality of arising, persisting for a while, and then passing away. And we can see that much more clearly with a boundless quality like metta. And then developing metta, of course, helps us accept our own shortcomings, our own underlying states of mind, much more easy. If we can relate to ourselves with a sense of care and kindness and well-wishing, spaciousness, then when we do experience our own shortcomings, when our, you know, petty grievances or anger or jealousy or whatever that, when that arises just from our own past conditioning, then we have the space to hold that and not get into a lot of self-critical, I shouldn't be that way, there I go again, you know, all the stories that we tell ourselves, the ways we hurt ourselves by criticizing. And we can see that and accept that much more easily, not be so hard on ourselves. And the less hard we are on ourselves, the less hard we will be on other people. So it extends outwards. If we're critical of ourselves a lot, you know, oftentimes we're actually maybe quietly critical of others. If we're critical of others, we often tend to be critical of ourselves. So, you know, we can be much more patient and accepting beings as we develop this kind of boundless, non-personal metta. And at its very best, it helps us to penetrate the noble truth of suffering. You know, because with a kind, spacious heart, we can really see how we get caught in old habits, we get caught in, you know, tripping ourselves up, and we can see how other people do that too from this quality of being able to look at our own shortcomings with kindness, that we can see the suffering that comes when we're ignorant of that, and then it helps us to really understand deeply the first noble truth, the cause of suffering, which provides a basis for us to learn how to be released from that. So I think I want to just leave that. That's kind of the raw introduction, in a sense, to personal love versus more boundless metta, and maybe just open it up for some questions, comments, discussion.
So, do you feel metta is to be developed, or do you feel metta is just an outcome of your life and your practice?
I mean, it can work both ways, but it is, you know, the more one develops the ability to, say, clear one's mind through meditation, using sila, using precepts as a base, not the precepts of non-harming. You know, we start with controlling our actions and our speech as a way of restraining ourselves from causing harm. That in itself, just by using that as a boundary that we set for ourselves as a mirror for reflection, then we can see the effect that has on ourselves and the world around us. And through something like practicing with precepts, developing tranquility meditation to help just soothe and calm and settle the mind, then there is a natural tendency to combine those with a sense of, you know, well-wishing and well-being, because we know how good it feels to ourselves, and we look around the world around us, and a natural sense of you know, wanting other people to feel that can arise as well. It's also something that oftentimes one has to direct oneself's mind towards, and oftentimes it starts with recognizing the pain of not having that, recognizing the pain of say having an angry mind or angry episode, and opening oneself up to that by seeing that and experiencing the pain of that, you know, kind of tendency, and having this wish to do it differently, and so recognizing the opposite sometimes gives us the motivation to learn how to redirect our attention in a skillful way. And that's what metta practice is, in a sense, is this use of what the Buddha calls yoniso manasikara, which is appropriate attention, so that we start to select certain qualities in our own hearts. We select certain qualities of being that we want to see in other people or that we want them to experience. We turn our attention to that and put our attention on that. So it is a training. And, you know, and we don't put attention on the signs and features, is how the Buddha refers to it, of things that will make us angry or upset or hostile. We start to learn how to skillfully and consciously divert our attention from absorbing into that and purposefully turning it towards, say, an object that will bring up a sense of well-being, of well-wishing, like somebody who has helped us in the past, the kindness that other people have shown us, remembering that, or some, you know, kind of skillful, helpful, kind interaction that you've had with somebody, whether it's you to them or them to you. You turn your attention to remembering those things and attending to those just to refresh and bring up that sense of well-being. So it's a quality that is, you know, can and should be cultivated and developed, as well as a quality that starts to arise much more naturally when you follow precepts and develop a meditation practice as well. Rick?
Yeah, maybe you can help define something. So it's like, here's this person, let's say there's someone causing harm, and I wish them well-being. I say, oh, I wish you well-being. In that person's mind, they're causing the harm is what brings them well-being, and per se, or am I wishing from my own perspective of learning that it's like, I'm wishing, you know, it's like, oh, being non-harm, being more generous and kind to others. So I'm wishing the well-being that I'm learning that is non-harm towards myself or to others. So if I go, oh, I wish you well-being, is there also in the mind that comes from non-harm, compassion? Or do I just say, I'm wishing you well-being, and it's a kind of person that actually doesn't care whether they harm or not? So I'm just, I'm trying to fine-tune that, if that makes sense in any way.
I think I understood at least the first part, that, you know, there are sometimes people who have a sense of gratification, you know, in what ends up being a harmful action on their part. And your wish for their well-being is a wish for their long-term well-being, or should be, not for just a short-term gratification. So if you see somebody who's kind of getting some kind of benefit or, you know, temporary gratification, but what they're doing is actually harmful in the long run, then your support of that, if you were to support that in some way, then that's not really actually in their best interest.
So if I'm wishing them,
you can still wish them
that you learn whether it comes from non-harm. So it's like, wow, I wish this person could find goodness that comes from non-harm.
Yeah, and that moves into the, you know, the experience of compassion. You see somebody who's actually engaging in harmful behavior, and you have a wishing for them not to be, you know, causing harm to themselves and to other people. That's a compassion for their suffering that they're going to be creating for themselves.
So is that metta then, or it's not metta, if it's more coming from that level?
Well, it should have a component of metta, because you are wishing for their well-being. But metta and compassion, like when you see somebody doing something that's going to be causing, or that's going to cause them suffering, or is causing them suffering, that doesn't mean that there isn't metta with it at all. So they're not mutually exclusive. So that kind of wishing for somebody to be non-harmful, not engaging in harm, is from a sense of wanting their well-being. So they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Cause sometimes it's like I find them come from compassion, but sometimes the Brahma Viharas are these separate things that are being presented. And yet I have found for myself, it seems, you know, the metta and the karuna really are mixed from in my own self.
They're just kind of, you know, they're all bound, all four of them are boundless qualities, just maybe kind of looking at the world of experience from a slightly different angle. And the response that comes up in different situations, whether it's seeing someone else's suffering or seeing someone else's joy and resonating with that. And then equanimity, adding the quality of discernment and wisdom through all of the Brahma Viharas. But it's interesting, the most commonly fleshed out Brahma Vihara that the Buddha talks about is metta, yeah. You know, at least in the original canon. Yeah. Tony.
I just wanted to share with you, Ajahn, from my perspective, which is from coming out of a very long-term relationship where somebody was killed in an accident after 42 years, that the way you presented the disadvantages and advantages of a conventional loving relationship perhaps was a little light on some of the advantages, because having been involved in Buddhism for the whole time during that relationship, I occasionally have thought, when it ended, would it have been better to have been a samana, a monastic, for that time, and not to go through this agony at the end? And I actually have a strong sense of gratitude that I had that experience. And occasionally over the last year or so since the accident, I've looked at monks and nuns and thought several things. One of them being they haven't gone through this distress, pain, suffering, which I think you described very eloquently. But equally, there's a richness behind the long-term in-depth relationship that requires a courage and has an intensity that, from long involvement with monks and nuns, they haven't had that experience directly. And so what you're saying is both true, but there is in order to balance the situation, there is another side to it. And you can't have had that experience directly, so it's not a criticism. But there's a joy to family life, and there's a richness that sometimes, and I have been involved with the Forest Sangha a long time, sometimes, and I think we all justify our own lifestyle and see things from that perspective for good reason. But I think sometimes there's an investment in people thinking they haven't sat on the side of a mountain for 30 years unnecessarily. And they have had both advantages from doing that, but they have also missed out from doing that.
No, I think that that's a very good perspective. And I think that there are certainly, as you describe, you know, when looked at with a clear Dhammic perspective, there's all sorts of very good things that one can learn from that kind of intensity of relationship. I'd also put out there that, you know, the monastic community isn't void of having intense emotional experiences. We have them on a regular basis here. It's not exactly the same, because it isn't involved with the same set of conditions, you know, that kind of intensity of a one-on-one relationship. But there's a different kind of intensity in having less personal but still very significant and powerful relationships with, say, monastic other members of the community, and living together 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with people that you actually wouldn't have chosen to live with outside of monastic life. You know, there's, you know, probably most of the monks who live here, you know, wouldn't necessarily have chosen to live with each other. because of, you know, just differences in personality and the ways. And so that creates a very potent cauldron for learning from very intense kind of relationship. So it isn't the same kind of intensity. It's a different kind of intensity, but it's, you know, like I say, monastic life. We aren't in shortage of any kind of intense relationships that we can learn from in a different way. So
I would say both ways up the mountain give you plenty of material to work with.
Absolutely.
There are different ways up the mountain.
Right. There are different ways up the mountain. At some point, though, you know, at least for me, you know, my reflection of having been involved in the world with personal relationships is, it's like there's a, and I'm just speaking personally here, not saying that this should be true for everybody, but there's this sense of realization that, for me, reflecting on not just this life, but on the, you know, at least in the Buddhist teachings that he describes as innumerable, you know, unimaginable, inconceivable eons of doing this over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, that there's a sense of like, okay, well maybe I don't have to keep learning over and over and over again in the same way. Maybe there is an alternative where I can still keep learning, but not have to go through the very high, beautiful things that one can experience in a personal relationship, and the very painful experiences when it changes. So for me, it's sort of this, it's more of a long-term perspective, just in terms of the monastic life. But that's not a prescription for saying that that's the way everybody should do it. You know, people have to find their own way. And if you can find the skill to deal with the intense difficulty and the learning that comes from having been involved in a very good personal relationship, if as long as you feel like you want to keep learning from that kind of experience, then, you know, that's certainly your choice. And you know, to use that wisely and with clarity with what you're moving into and what you'll get from it.
Thank you. Yeah, I think also it's worthy of note that in there's a couple in the time of the Buddha who the first time they met the Buddha, they addressed him as his son, or their son, and the Buddha said after, clarified it after, saying that, well, I have been born as their son over many, many lifetimes, and then also they were kind of the ideal couple, and then when one of them passed, or when they were getting toward their old age, because they reached old age together, and then they asked asking how to be reborn so that they were maintained their connection in future lives. And the Buddha didn't say, "Yeah, I'll forget that. You know, go off and ordain as a monk or a nun." He prescribed. He said, "Well, just to keep that cultivation of the qualities of the faith, of virtue, of generosity, of wisdom that you're cultivating together, and those are the qualities that lay the foundation for that ongoing wholesome relationship." So I think it's helpful to sort of, because sometimes it is easy to sort of glean out from the teachings where the Buddha is saying, every little bit of dearness is going to make you miserable. It's also the Buddha is giving the prescriptions of how to cultivate these really wholesome attachments, a wholesome love, based in these skillful qualities.
So maybe we should pull this part of the teachings to a close now. It's 2:00. Should we take a break, a quick break, and then come back or continue on now?
I think we're okay to continue on for a bit.
Yeah.
People okay?
Yeah. Okay. Let's continue on then.
Should I keep talking or should we meditate?
You're in charge now.
Maybe we could meditate just for a few minutes. And could I have the bell? And while we're meditating, take on as a thought exercise or a contemplation, what does love mean to you? Meditate for about 10 minutes. Thinking like, what is love? What does love mean to you? or even just when you hear the word love, what sort of feeling arises? Whether it's a good feeling or a feeling of dread, or just neutral. Okay, I'm going to read from Ajahn Jayasaro's On Love for a little bit, and then see where we go with that. Dhamma practice involves looking closely at our mind, its thoughts and emotions. It involves recognizing, for example, the role that desires play in determining our experiences, how we often see what we want to see. Suppose, for example, that we have decided that those whom we can love must have such and such qualities. But then when we fall in love and it turns out they lack some or all of these qualities, many of us will fool ourselves that this is not so. We do this by projecting the ideals in our minds over the reality of our loved ones until we finally see only what we want to see in them. This is obviously not the best foundation for a healthy relationship. In extreme cases, it will turn out that we are hardly relating to the persons themselves at all, but to our idea of who they are. It is unsurprising that when they act in ways that conflict with our idea, we can feel an irrationally bitter sense of hurt. Learning how to recognize the ideals, desires, and expectations that we project onto the other is a difficult task, but an important one if we are to reduce our suffering. How often do we feel upset about the way a loved one has acted? Not so much because of the action itself, but because of its implications for certain of our most cherished assumptions. Learning about ourselves gives us a better understanding of others, because, essentially, in looking at our own mind, we are studying the nature of the human mind itself. We start to become more empathic and see that good intentions in the absence of wisdom are not always enough. Women who recognize the faults of their partners often decide to make a project out of reforming their loved ones. Although they approach their task with love and sincerity, they often act in ways interpreted by their partners as a criticism of who they are, leading them to feel hurt and become stubborn. Loving our partners ought not to mean being obligated to turn a blind eye to their deficiencies or to side with them in every case, but to be able to help them to change. We need patience, perseverance, and a respect for and acceptance of the present situation. Starting off from the position that they should be other than the way they are is one extreme to be avoided. Assuming that they will always be the way they are right now is the other extreme. The middle way involves an understanding of causes and conditions and of the art of the possible. Giving an exaggerated importance to love has many drawbacks. In extreme cases, the deification of love can lead to violence or murder. Crimes of passion are classic tabloid fodder. Perhaps a jilted lover kills the one who has rejected him, or kills her new lover, or kills them both, or kills himself, or kills them both and then kills himself. Such tragedies may not occur so often, but how many people, unhappy in love, dream of violence every now and again? A huge number, I would imagine. The true culprit is not a person, but an identification with love, thinking that a life without loving a particular person is worthless and meaningless. Such thoughts are a sign of low LQ. People with low love intelligence are capable of killing or destroying anything except their own ignorance. Another distressing situation concerns the huge number of women all over the world who routinely get beaten by their partners. I once saw a British police statistic showing almost 500,000 cases of reported domestic violence a year. Women with bruises all over their bodies, broken arms, broken ribs, etc., are being treated in hospitals daily. Some die. And why do so many tormented women agree to go back and live with their abusive lovers? Some tolerate it for the sake of their children, some out of fear, some out of inertia or because they have nowhere to go, but perhaps most often it is because of love. A lover, no longer drunk or enraged, often insists in tears that he loves his partner. He apologizes and asks for the last chance, and she then admits she still loves him and agrees with hope that things will be better from now on. So he's given one more chance over and over again, because the abuser's regret easily dissolves, usually in alcohol. So many awful things in the world are justified in the name of love. And domestic violence is not a one-way street. Violent acts perpetrated by women against men are widespread, at least in the West, and hugely underreported. In the early stage of love, our lover probably looks good in almost every way. Even visible flaws seem adorable, or seem at most like a tiny imperfection that true love should ignore. We think it doesn't matter that there are differences, whether generally or in comma, character, value, viewpoint, and belief. We think it doesn't matter. We love each other. Everything else will fall into place. But after being married for a while, irritants that used to lurk quietly in the background tend to move to a more prominent position or even take center stage. A couple wise enough to let go of their viewpoints, adapt, and make compromises, they can survive. But many couples begin to learn a bitter lesson that love is an unreliable vaccine against suffering. When pride and opinions collide, the words, "That's not how it is, that's not how it should be, I can't accept that, no way, no," keep coming up. Do we still love each other? Yes, but... The Buddha taught that the principal condition for a couple to live together happily is a shared standard of conduct, beliefs, and values. That's like Ajahn Kurdadama was, or Lungpa was mentioning with Nakula Mata and Nakula Pita, the couple who wanted to stay together in their future lives. Shared standards of conduct, beliefs, and values. Naturally, we are advised to consider this point well before rather... Naturally, we are advised to consider this point well before rather than after agreeing to join our life with another's. We might, through love, be able to put up with the fundamental differences of opinion and conduct with our partner, but it won't be easy, and things become more fraught with children in the picture. Love may well form part of an emotionally fulfilling and stable life, but it must be founded on morality, accompanied by the cultivation of inner virtues, and above all, governed by wisdom. That wisdom is initially founded on a reflection on the Dhamma principles that all things are impermanent and uncertain. All impermanent things are inherently imperfect. When we want something impermanent to be permanent and something imperfect to be perfect, we create suffering for ourselves. An interest in learning how to look at our life free from bias is vital if we want to transcend our destructive habits. The fundamental thesis of the Buddha's teaching is that as long as our hearts and minds are infected with negative qualities, we will never experience true happiness. But while love cannot replace the need for spiritual development, it can support it. What is needed is for us to help each other overcome our negativities by learning the Dhamma and applying it. I'll stop there. So just stopping at that paragraph that's talking about combining love, or I'll use the word metta now, with wisdom. The translation in Thai for metta is one that I like. It's just goodwill, which is kwam wung di, which is just goodwill and wishing well. So I like to think of metta in terms of that, because that's something we can do even if we don't necessarily like somebody. We can still wish them well. And we can also wish ourselves well. We can try to say to ourselves, may you be well. May I be well. May I be free of suffering. So these standard stock phrases come up in terms of trying to spread metta to ourselves. And then when the Buddha talked about metta, he talked about spreading it to yourself, or having metta for yourself first, and then it can spread out to others. And I can talk a little bit about in my own practice. I very much overlooked this in the beginning, just because it seemed kind of, you know, I wanted like the real practice. I wanted the hard practice, not like the soft kind of cushy metta practice. And uh, all the while, I was keeping a journal when I first came here. Like I was keeping a journal of whatever my experiences were each day or each week. And I remember after the journal was full, going back and reading it, and the theme was very, very clear. I mean, it was really a lot of like kind of insights and some being inspired by teachings, but it was all with an angle of criticizing myself or being very self-critical, self-judgmental, and that was a very strong theme. And much so, I ended up thinking, that's kind of interesting. And it certainly didn't feel good reading it. And, but much later than practicing in Thailand, and after being a monk for about 8 or 9 years, coming full circle to this idea that, okay, trying to have metta for myself. And I decided I would diligently do metta practice, but then a lot of the phrases were just sort of falling flat. So wishing myself, say, may I be well, may I be happy. And then I would get a little bit irritated doing those recitations for myself, kind of like, this is kind of dumb. And but then I was diligently doing it. Okay, I have to have metta for myself. And but then kind of one night, just sort of giving up and thinking and feeling very self-critical as well, and kind of this sort of unpleasant sensation in the heart. But then thinking, I'm going to try a little bit of a different angle. I'm going to tell myself, you know, I don't hate you. I don't hate myself. And try that angle. And it was kind of like this heart-opening experience. And then another part of my mind said, yes, you do. And then another part of my mind said, no, you don't. And then there was kind of this argument. And so then it became like, I don't hate myself. I won't hate myself. I refuse to hate myself. And then I think that was one of the first times I actually can claim that I felt metta for myself. And then after that, it was much easier. But it was kind of like, then it was this very heart-opening, warm experience. And that made me think, oh yeah, to really have metta, you do have to couple it with wisdom, just like that last paragraph of Ajahn Jayasaro that I just read. If it's tempered with wisdom or coupled with wisdom, you actually have to see where you aren't having metta for yourself. And when you see clearly where you aren't having metta for yourself, then you're able to adapt and adjust it so that you do have metta for yourself. Yeah. So let me just open it up for questions again, if that brings up anything for anybody.
I really appreciate the honesty of your sharing. I admire you for doing it in front of so many people. What came up for me was that in terms of self-criticism, over the years, what brought about any shift was being authentic, that whilst I wanted not to be critical, it was still there. And by watching that process and maybe not identifying with it so much, it gradually shifted until I was made more able to wish myself well genuinely. But when I was faking it, just because that's what a good Buddhist would do, they wouldn't be self-critical, it was like quicksand. I just sunk deeper and deeper into it. But change does happen over time by a process of awareness, really. And I've built up a lot more confidence in that. But it has to be real. It has to be authentic. Which yours was. I mean, I really admired how you shared it.
Yeah, there's like there's the ideals and then there's the reality.
Back there.
There was something in the passage you read that brought me back to the exchange that you had earlier. There was an analogy that maybe in a couple, that the foundation of love would be a commitment to sila, in fact, moral conduct of each other, shared values, which really makes explicit the idea that the marriage vows are like the precepts, right? Mm-hmm. This is the way we live together in non-harming. And it's a very moving idea of what love and marriage would be like that actually resonates with my own marriage in a way that it's a different way of seeing a relationship that, for me, makes much more sense of it than the one that we're given. That this person is my precious whatever, you know, all mine. Doesn't really resonate at all. My wife and I would say are committed to a life of service, and that's the joy we find in our relationship. So I appreciate that analogy. It also, of course, brings together the 42 years and the 30 years on the mountain, this thing that you were working with earlier. It's,
I would like to add a little bit more. After I love myself, I try. After myself getting stronger, and I practice five pieces of, and practice meditation, I think we can loving others more. Loving kindness instead of just love, I spread to loving kindness or metta to anyone in the family, in a workplace, or anywhere that I meet people. It's not easy to do, but meditation help my mind. A little bit. I think I can love others more and more.
Yeah. Yes.
I thought to be self-critical is a way to improve yourself, to know how and where you need to improve yourself. So how is being self-critical something not good for yourself?
Yeah, I in my opinion, because I also had that thought, I need to kind of, beat myself often so that I can fall into line but then I found that actually sapped, took a lot of energy away, with metta for yourself, you have a lot more energy. So you can know there in Buddhism there is right and wrong, and there is things we should and shouldn't do. But the problem occurs when our ideals are so high that we can't possibly meet them. So I came here and I thought, okay, if I spend 8 months here and just, I don't know why I thought 8 months, but 8 months and practice as hard as I can, then I'll be enlightened. And then when you get to 8 months and you're not enlightened, you idiot, you weren't practicing hard enough. And so it's just unrealistic. I think if a criticism or whatever, it's realistic, but it has to be, if it's not out of goodwill for ourselves, if it's out of the angle of trying to destroy or kill our defilements, then that might be less useful than if it's from the angle of trying to lift ourselves, maybe lift ourselves out of it, lift ourselves out of the defilements. But you kind of need both. But
yeah. Thanks, Roger. An analogy of forming a sculpture, one, you could use a hammer on metal and try and beat it into shape, or you could perhaps use something more like clay and gently mold it into shape. But both can get to the a similar shape, but it's how you go about doing it. And as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, I think at this point, a lot of times I've tried to beat myself into shape, and maybe with this type of practice, it's more of a molding, which sounds much more pleasant. So, trying to do that again.
Or if you even say make the goal like having metta for yourself. Say, so then that entails not beating yourself. So like there's this kind of paradox, like Ajahn Amaro used to say a lot, like the beatings won't stop until morale improves. So like at a certain point you just have to stop. You just have to decide to stop. And yeah, but it's not easy.
You know, it's interesting from what Ajahn Jayasaro shared and kind of what I'm hearing and reflecting on in life, that how much love is equated to actually nonviolence. The nonviolence inward and the nonviolence outward. And I know when we were sitting and you had asked that question, it's like, when I felt love, I said, I wish the violence would stop. You know, I see all this violence that we do outward towards each other. And then I also see inwards in the work that I do. And it's just, there was actually tears in my eyes because there is this, it's like non-violence, wish it would stop. And honoring that, it's like, that's where I actually settled. And I think it's, someone you were saying, that's where it's like, then all of a sudden I noticed, oh, there's just breath, there's just sitting, there's just this, there isn't even the thought of violence or non-violence anymore, but love brought up this idea that love, that it has to seem to have to look at the non-violent, look at it from a non-violent point of view to see where the violence is happening. And it's so much, I think as you were saying, inward, and then we bring it outward. There's so much of that in the world. And I think breaking down as we're here today, which I'm really appreciating, love, showing how much of that has to be looked at to stop the violence within towards ourselves or other people. Mm-hmm.
Good.
Take a break.
Should we keep going? Take a break?
I need to break.
Okay. Take a 10 minute break or something?
15 minute break.
Come back.